next speaker is Bob Leeming, and I'll just load up his presentation.
Thanks, Paul, and thanks, Ted, for that very moving account. I'm going to talk now about the legislative framework that was in place before the disaster, which won't take very long, and you'll understand why, and a little bit about what happened afterwards. I'm sorry that you won't be able to read this at the back. I tried to make it big enough writing, but so that's really the structure of what I'm going to talk about. So I also have a bit of a connection with Aberfan. When I first got appointed as Her Majesty's Inspector of Mines and Quarries at the time in 1987, I was moved to Cardiff. I was based in Cardiff. One of the mines that I was allocated was Merthyr Vale. That name meant nothing to me. It was just another one of a whole list of collieries that the Coal Board ran down here that I was responsible for looking after. And when I got there, the manager, whose name was Simon Reed, he says, "You realise this is the Aberfan pit, don't you?" And I says, "No, how am I supposed to know that?" You know. And it was then I realised that the disaster was named after the village rather than the colliery, which is unusual. And so he says, "There are a lot of men here who still work here, who had kids in the school and went to dig them out. So just bear that in mind as you're going around the mine." So of course I did that. The other thing he said was, "You ought to go and have a look at the cemetery. It's worth going to." And I did, and I went up there and looked at all the graves. And it struck me that, as Ted had described, the ages of all the deceased were 7, 8, 9, 10. I was 9 at the time of this disaster. I remember it as well, watching the black and white pictures. And it struck me that if, bar from an accident of birth, if I'd not been born in Stoke-on-Trent, if I'd have been born in Aberfan, I'd have been in that school, and I might not be stood here now. So I have quite a connection with that. Anyhow, I just wanted to put this one up, just to put it in perspective. Aberfan is fantastically bad, but it is not the worst that we've had in the UK. It is actually number 17 in the list of worst mining-related disasters. And just a couple of points I'd like to just highlight on that. Aberfan was unique in that none of the people that worked at the mine were affected. All the deceased were members of the public. And for that reason, at the time, the law didn't require either the deaths to be notified, because they were not employees, nor the fact that the tip had slid, because that wasn't a reportable incident either. And the other one of note on there is Hartley, number 8, where all the men and boys who died in that one were all overcome by carbon monoxide poisoning. 4 of those 21 on there were in Glamorgan. They are all in the same county. So, before the disaster, the principal piece of legislation that was in force that governed health and safety at mines and quarries was the Mines and Quarries Act 1954. And the only mention of tipping in that act was that the premises for the time being used for depositing refuse from a mine or quarry shall be deemed to form part of that mine or quarry. The word tip did not occur in that legislation, and that was about the limit of the thought that was given to disposal of refuse. It was really a matter of, this is unsellable material, what can we do with it? Get it off site, dump it. And in the case of the Taff Valley, of course, the bottom of the valley, which would be the ideal place, had got a railway, a canal, a river, a road, housing. So where else could they go? They went up the slope on the other side, and that was not uncommon in a lot of mines, actually. So the trigger for change, of course, as Ted's ably described, was the sliding of Tip 7 down the hillside, with about, it was estimated, about 280,000 tonnes of material that was on the move and came down the hillside. That's a picture of the aftermath of it. It's just the stark reality of it, really. Unbelievable. So what happened immediately after? First of all, there was a public inquiry that Ted's quoted from at length. One of the big things was an acknowledgement that tips posed a potential threat, and tips on a slope posed a greater potential threat. And as a result of that, some tips were reprofiled. When I was at that age, at that time, I could see a tip from my bedroom window. It was Chatterley Whitfield. That tip was a conical tip. It was built on flat land, actually, but it was a conical tip, and that got reprofiled, and they took the top off. That made it unstable. It hadn't moved before, but that started making it unstable, and it went on fire as well. In fact, my father told me a story, because he used to work there. When they took the big scraper machines up there to reprofile this, they couldn't stop them because the material was so hot it would set the tyres on fire, so they had to keep them moving while they were on the tip. Some tips were closed and relocated, and the Merthyr Vale tip was one of them, and tipping was stopped on the site that had been the disaster site. And future tipping occurred further up the valley towards Merthyr Tydfil, and that continued up until the closure of the mine in the late 80s, about 1989, I think it was. There was also recognition that the law was inadequate. That was plainly obvious, because there was no law that existed effectively that governed anything to do with tips. So new law was written, and a lot of research was done, which Alan will talk about shortly, on slope stability and ground stability and rock mechanics and that sort of thing. So in 1969, the Mines and Quarries Tips Act was enacted, and that was in two parts. The first part was to make provisions as to mines and quarries tips, and these regulations covered mines and quarries, and did up until recent times, when mining law and quarry law was split, and there are now quarry regulations that govern tips and mining regulations that govern tips, but they both say essentially the same thing. The 69 Act, or Part 1 of the Act, defined the ownership of the tip, and it made it quite clear where the responsibility lay for what happened on the tip. It gave duties to the owner and to the manager, and it also provided for notices that could be served by an inspector. That power is now embodied in the Health Safety at Work Act 1974. Incidentally, the report that recommended that piece of law was written by Robins, who was the Coal Board chairman at the time. So if he'd have lost his job over that, you know, who knows where we would have been. It also required notification of various activities on the tip, mainly the starting or resumption or stopping of tipping operations, and that notification was to the enforcing authority, which was the Mines Inspectorate and Mines and Quarries at the time. And it required plans and sections of the tip, and also the underlying strata to be kept. Now, Part 2 of the Act dealt with disused tips or abandoned tips, and this was directed at making sure that disused tips did not constitute a danger to the public. The first part was to do with active tips that were being tipped on. The second part was to do with tips that are no longer active, may not be associated with a working mine or quarry, and they just sat there. And the local authorities were given the powers, firstly, to require information from owners of the tips, and the local authority could also carry out their own inspections of the tips to ascertain the stability of the tip. They could, if they decided that there were remedial measures that needed taking, they could require the owner to take those measures. If the owner couldn't or wouldn't, then the local authority had the power to enter the site themselves and do the work. And they could then recover the costs of that from the owner through the courts if necessary. And at that time, when the 69 Act came out, it modified the 1954 Act to bring tips properly into scope. 2 years after the Tips Act, there were a set of regulations, the Mines and Quarries Tips Regulations, and they set out the general requirements, mainly talking about responsibility for draining, supervision, maintenance and inspection of all new and existing tips. And this was really the detail about how you do it. The Act talked about what is the aim, what should be done, and this was more of the detail. And if we were writing this again, which we've done recently, then the goal setting requirements came from the Act, and the regulatory specifics now would appear in guidance. The regulations don't apply to abandoned tips; they only apply to active tips. Part 2 of the TIPS Act still applies. That was not revoked a couple of years ago. That's still in place. So for all active TIPS, there have to be suitable drainage arrangements. You can see all the things that came out of the tribunal, all the things that were wrong, all the contributory factors, they've all been dealt with by the TIPS Act and the TIPS regs. They've all been recognised and measures have been put in place to prevent a recurrence. It's a shame about most of our legislation. It's reactive. It waits for a disaster, and then we put loads of rules and regulations in place to stop it happening again. It would be much better if we could see it coming the first time and avoid it. But there you go. So there's got to be suitable drainage arrangements. The TIPS got to be supervised, inspected, and defects recorded. And the TIPS were divided into two classes, if you like. The smaller TIPS were sort of non-classified TIPS, and the bigger TIPS that were deemed to pose a bigger hazard were termed classified TIPS. And the definition of a classified TIP was to do with size, it was to do with height, and it was to do with the underlying gradient, anything more than 1 in 12. So the Aberband TIPS would certainly have been classified because they were on something like 1 in 4. And they had more... I could miss one there. Oh, yes, that was the solid TIPS. Also, you can have liquid TIPS, you can have lagoons, and they come into scope, and again, it's... 10,000 cubic metres volume brings it into scope. It becomes a classified TIP, and any part of it, including any embankment or wall or containing structure, if any of that is more than 4 metres above any of the surrounding land within 50 metres, that is also classified. And the classified TIPs, because of their perceived increased potential risk, had more stringent requirements put them on. The intention to construct had to be notified in advance. That's not just the starting of operation, but this is the starting of the planning of it now. The owner had got to obtain all the geological plans and sections. He needed a plan of the proposed TIP site and the area for 250 metres around it. And that had to show all mine workings underneath, because subsidence can be an issue if it's shallow. Previous land slips. Incidentally, the TIP 7 had already moved, and when they started tipping back on it, they started tipping in the hole that had already moved. So, I mean, that's a bit stupid, isn't it? You know, the way it just is. And they'd also got to identify springs, arterial wells, water courses, all the things that were contributory factors to the Aberband disaster, and any other factors that might affect the security of the TIP. So it was very wide, very general. And then before tipping could commence, the owner had got to provide a civil engineering report. So if he'd not got the expertise in-house, he'd got to buy it in and get an engineering report on the method of carrying out the tipping operations and any other matter that might affect the security of the tip. They've got to work out how much was going to be deposited in total, how big the tip was going to be, how much, what rate it was going to be tipped on. And it also had to make reference to all the surveys and tests that had previously been carried out on underlying strata, the superficial deposits, water courses and all things like that. Anything that could affect the stability of the tip. It had to reference the plans of the land that had got to be tipped on, looking at gradients of land, heights, contours, boundaries. The list is almost endless, but it directs attention at all the contributory factors that might be important, and also the nature and location of types and refuse, because it's a relatively dry solid goes down, and there's the tailings that go down, and there's liquid within the tip. On occasion, you can have a liquid lagoon within a solid tip. That's fine as long as it's done properly. And the specification for depositing and compaction was very important. The Aberband tip wasn't compacted at all, which helped the water to get in it, both from underneath and from rainfall. And the arrangements for inspection and supervision. So during its operation, there had to be detailed tipping rules, which not only talked about the stability of the tip, but also the safety of the people building it. So it talked about transport rules and haul road gradients, hedge protection and things like that, quite detailed. There was a statutory mines and quarries book for recording the amount weekly that was deposited. There were likewise books for recording inspections, daily inspections, weekly inspections and monthly inspections. There was another book, a mines and quarries statutory book for defects, and the defects of course had to be actioned. You couldn't just write it down that there's a problem at so and so location, you've got to do something about it. And there had to be, after the initial civil engineering stability assessment, there had to be another one, a repeat every 2 years, to have another look and make sure things were going as planned. And if not, then what was going to be done about it? And the conclusions of that report had to contain a statement on the future stability of the tip. As I mentioned earlier on, the incident was not reportable at all, either for the deaths or for the fact that the tip had moved. The existing regulations concerning notification were the notification of accidents and dangerous occurrence regulations. They were altered, they were amended to include moving tips or unstable tips. The regulations have gone through a number of iterations since. The current version is the reporting of diseases, injuries, diseases and dangerous occurrences regulations. And that it now requires any event, including any movement of material or any fire, which is another cause of instability, which indicates that a tip to which the Mines Regulations 2014 apply is or is likely to become insecure. The TIPS regulations, or part one of the TIPS Act and all the TIPS regulations, were revoked in 2015 and replaced by the Mines Regulation. All the mining legislation was revoked essentially and replaced with one set. So we came down from about more or less 1,000 individual regulations down to 70. We eliminated duplication and stuff that was out of date and things like that. But we've got a few regulations on TIPS. The mines regulations are very specific to mining activities and mining hazards. They don't talk about slipping and they don't talk about lifting operations. They don't talk about pure stuff. Anything that's in legislation of general application is left there, and any repeat that we did have in mining legislation is now gone, so that's really why we've got down to 70 regs. But what we've tried to take forward and keep are all the salient features of the old TIPS Act and TIPS regs. And they did stand the test of time very well, because since 69 and 71, when they were enacted, we have had no cause to alter them, and we've had no cause to write any exemptions from them either, so that really is a mark of how good they were. So basically what we're after is, what the law is requiring now, is that TIPS are designed, constructed, operated and maintained to make sure that they're stable and there's no movement, which is likely to give rise to a risk to the health and safety of any person, so it's not just employees, it's any person, is avoided. So that's an absolute duty on the mine operator. And there are some specific requirements which again reflect and mirror what had gone before. We've kept everything that was really important and really significant and really made the difference. So it's pre-planning, it's assessment, it's appraisals. We've retained the concept of the higher hazard tips. They're now known as notifiable tips rather than classified tips, but the principles are the same. It's all about size, volume, height, slope, that sort of thing. And again, we've kept the requirement for geological assessments and refuse tip records and the provision of detailed tipping rules, all of which have helped to keep things basically safe in the intervening years between then and now. I just wanted to cover very briefly another event. This is another tip slide, which happened in 2013. So although we've had all these rules and regulations since 1969 to try and stop this, and if you follow the rules properly, it does stop this, but if you don't follow the rules properly, then you can run into trouble. And this was a case. This was a very slow movement. It was a failure of the side of the tip. And it affected the Scunthorpe to Goole railway line near Doncaster. And it basically pushed the tracks out of line, and it moved the tracks 5 metres vertically, so the underneath of the tracks heaved up. The tracks were pushed 20 metres horizontally, and there were 300 metres of length of track that were affected by this. That's on the first day, and you can see on the left of the picture is the tip, and there's four railway lines here. There's two fast lines and two slow lines. And you can see on the left of the picture, I hope you can see on the left of the picture, there's a bit of a bulge. And the movement started somewhere around lunchtime on the Saturday. And a train driver running across this reported a bit of an uneven ride. It was a bit bumpy or something like that. So they sent some track inspectors out, Network Rail didn't have a look at it. And they saw this was starting to develop. So within a few hours, they'd stopped all the train movements. It ended up day two, it had got to that. So you can see why they stopped the trains. Pay good money to Alton Towers for a ride like that. That was day four. So even their track rail system would struggle on that, I think. That's an aerial view of it, and that just shows the extent of it. That's about 300 metres from top to, probably about 400 metres actually, top to bottom of that picture. And you can see the cracks in the... You can see the cracks in the side of the flank of the tip, and all this lot sort of bulged out. There is a lagoon, liquid tip, within the body of the solid tip, which may or may not have been significant, probably was. That track was closed for 8 weeks, to put this right. There was about 1 million cubic metres of material had to be moved, not just the stuff that had moved, but stuff behind that to stop any further problems. That's over 2 million tonnes of material. It cost 60 million quid to put that right. Network Rail are still arguing about who's going to pay that. They coughed up because they wanted the track back in operation, and they are still trying to recover that from Hatfield Colliery. But the significant thing about that was the lucky thing possibly, because of where it was and because of how slowly it happened, there were no injuries as a result of that. So why did it happen? It was because they didn't follow best practice. That's the top and bottom of it. What you should do is lay the tip down in horizontal layers, no more than 5 foot or 1.5 metres thick, and you should compact them by running vehicles over and over and over them. Track vehicles, wheeled vehicles, doesn't really matter. Motorised rollers, vibrating rollers, it doesn't matter. And the idea is that you tip back from the edge, and you bulldoze a bit over the edge and then compact it, and then you gradually make the tip bigger laterally by doing that. But what they did was very similar to what had happened at Aberfan. They extended the tip sideways by tipping over the edge, and they would run a dump truck to the edge of the tip, tip the back up, tip the material down the slope, and the tip grew like that from a great height rather than in very thin layers. There was no compaction, of course, and the layers of the tip, instead of being horizontal, which helps to keep water out of the body of the tip, they were actually at the angle of repose of the tipping material as it went over the edge. So all the planes in the tip were at 45 degrees or something like that. So any water, any rain that fell on the top just soaked straight in, and that's why it failed. We would have prosecuted them for that, but we couldn't find the responsible people, because this mine had changed hands a number of times, and there were a number of owners that had been practicing this tipping, and to actually pin it down as to who was actually to blame just wasn't worth the effort at the end of the day, so we didn't get there. But I think Network Rail are still trying, and this is like 3 years after. So in conclusion then, after the event, what's happened? Tips are now properly planned, they're properly sited, they're properly drained, they're properly inspected, and they're properly supervised. And that really is the legacy of Aberfan. The legislation stood the test of time, as I described before. We've not changed it up until repealing the lot and replacing it. We've not written any exemptions for it. And despite what Ted said about the rest of the world, where they've not got this message, and it's really disappointing they've not got this message, because we've learned it, we've got it written down, all they've got to do is read the books and the literature. It's not just tipping, it falls aground, it's coldest explosions, you name it, we've learned it the hard way. The rest of the world have got to learn it themselves the hard way, it would appear. But we've had no further reported injuries caused by unstable tips in this country since the Lavan events. I covered that at the start, so that's it. Thank you very much.